T 90.3 FM。
Tune in to CKUT 90.3 FM, Tuesdays, 3 p.m. to 5 p.m. for a special Black History Month edition of the Montreal Sessions. The month kicks off on February 1st with the best in reggae and soca with your hosts, Production Sounds and Soca Head. Week 2, February 8th, Wizzy Moonchaser, host of the Morning Detour, broadcast live from DG Kicks, a sneaker store in NDG. Final 2 weeks, 15th and 22nd, are hosted by Stephen Ziplocks Hennessy, educator, creator,
and part of the Ill Groove Garden team. Don't miss it.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
Hi.
C is for
cauliflower.
Confusion. Creation.
Pickle. K is for
kitten.
Cam.
C, wait. Sandroof. C. U, unbearable.
U is for underground.
Oh, yeah.
Umbrella.
T. Trite.
Tremendous.
Torment.
Tire.
C. K.
I can't think of a U one. T.
T.
F is for famous.
Fun. Fumble. M is for Montreal.
But first, some news. Premier François Legault says Quebec is dropping its plan to tax non-vaccinated people for the strain they put on the healthcare system. Legault says dropping the plan preserves, quote, social cohesion, end quote. Gyms will be allowed to open at half capacity starting February 14th. Bars remain closed and restaurants can run at half capacity. Saturday marked the fifth anniversary of the Quebec City mosque attack, which left 6 men dead and 5 others severely injured. It was also the first National Day of Remembrance of the Quebec City Mosque Attack and Action Against Islamophobia. This will take place annually on January 29th. 800 steelworkers are on strike in Longueuil 2 days after their contracts with the Syndicat des Métallos expired this week. 99% of the workers at the Longueuil plant support the strike. They want higher salaries. The union states that negotiations remain in a stalemate. A high school on Montreal's South Shore is under fire for a racist homework assignment. George Stetka's daughter was assigned homework last week that depicted racialized cartoon characters. Stetka says the assignment contributes to harmful stereotypes of people of color. The school board is expected to issue a press release on the matter shortly. And as of February 1st, Black History Month has officially begun. You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM.
In the case of symptoms similar to those of COVID-19, such as fever, cough, sore throat, loss of taste, or smell, you should take a rapid home screening test. If you test positive, isolate yourself at home and please follow the self-isolation instructions. If you don't have a rapid home screening test, please self-isolate for the recommended period. Visit quebec.ca/self-isolating for complete instructions on how to protect yourself and others. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
The National Greening Program, run by Tree Canada, is dedicated to planting seedling trees across Canada in BC, the Prairies, Ontario, Quebec, and the Atlantic. They prioritize planting on Indigenous and public lands and planting areas of natural and human-caused disturbance. The trees they plant help filter the air and water and sequester carbon, among other positive impacts. To learn more or get involved, go to treecanada.ca.
Welcome back to CKUT's Friday Off the Hour. The time is just after 5 p.m. My name is Brian Jefferson. Up first on this episode of Off the Hour, we're sharing the air with producers of The Final Straw Radio. We'll tune into an episode about Black Revolution and author William Anderson's book, written by Zoe Samaduzzi, called As Black as Resistance. We'll bring you back at the top of the hour with some news that you can use.
The views expressed on The Final Straw Radio do not necessarily reflect those of Asheville FM, Friends of Community Radio, or any of the affiliate radio stations airing the show. Airing first on Asheville FM, WSFM LP at 103.3 FM in Asheville, North Carolina, this is The Final Straw, and I'm William Goodenough. The show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can email us with questions, comments, or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. Also, if you're interested in rebroadcasting any episode or segment of the show, you're free to do so. Just send us an email if you end up using any content. If you care to, you can send us letters at our new address, which is The Final Straw Radio, P.O. Box 6004, Asheville, North Carolina, 28816. The show is brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee. Located at 610 Haywood Road, Firestorm Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. You can find a sample of Firestorm's catalog of books and zines, plus a full calendar of events at their website, firestorm.coop. This week on The Final Straw, we are super pleased to present a talk given at the most recent Asheville Anarchist Book Fair by William C. Anderson, who co-authored the book As Black as Resistance with Zoe Samudzi. The talk he is giving here is based heavily on the first chapter of the book called Black in Anarchy, and in addition to laying the groundwork of how he and Samudzi wrote the book, he speaks about the truly conditional nature of so-called citizenship that many people living in the U.S. face, the continuing evolution of race, and the reliance of white supremacy to black subjugation, and he places blackness in proximity to anarchy in this really interesting way, and much more. From the back cover, quote, "As Black as Resistance makes the case for a new program of self-defense and transformative politics for black Americans, one rooted in an anarchistic framework that the authors liken to the black experience itself. This is not a book of compromise, nor does it negotiate with intolerance. It is a manifesto for everyone who is ready to continue progressing toward liberation for all people." End quote. We hope you will enjoy this talk, and if you are curious about the book As Black as Resistance by Zoe Samudzi and William C. Anderson, you can head over to AK Press to learn more at akpress.org. First though, buds, we are not even halfway through August 2018, and already so much has happened. People have worked hard and fought harder, sweated and bled, have sustained near-fatal injury and assaults of many kinds, and put their bodies on the literal line to face the largest mobilized fascist group in the country. I'm speaking, of course, of the police, whose roots in slavery and white supremacy are indisputable, and which are making themselves crystal clear in these battles. If you'll bear with me, and speaking on a personal note for a moment, I was someone who was in Charlottesville both last year and this year. And I am someone who has experienced trauma from cops and white supremacists and the structural cis heteropatriarchy. And I was just a few feet away from that intersection of Northeast 4th Street between Market and Water in Seaville, which is now called Heather Heyer Way. I want to say that it has been beyond inspirational to see the resiliency of anti-fascists, this past year especially. I've seen y'all out there in person when I've been able to, and white-knuckled my way through news reports and text updates when I haven't. I'll simply say, because I could probably talk a lot about this, that what I see gives me life and brings me the kind of joy that is often lacking in the everyday grind. This last year has changed and affected us all, and I feel it's important, maybe even crucial, right now to acknowledge the job we're doing and to also acknowledge the strength that we've exhibited against some pretty steep odds. Thanks for listening to that, y'all. Hopefully it wasn't too awkward. It will come as no surprise that there were arrests this weekend. One of the arrests included a brutal assault on a trans comrade, which included threats and violence not only from the police, but from a known fascist doxer as well in Charlottesville. The link for this comrade's survival and defense fund is paypal.me/LARA757,
and any leftover funds will be distributed to other trans comrades.
Likewise, there has been a request for court support for a couple of folks, Veronica and Toby, on August 23rd at 9:45 a.m. in the Charlottesville General District Court at 606 East Market Street. More information can be found by following at SolidCville on Twitter. If you're in North Carolina, there's a day of solidarity with Maya Little, who's facing charges for allegedly marking a Confederate statue, Silent Sam, on the UNC Chapel Hill's campus with paint and her own blood on Monday, August 20th. The demonstration of solidarity will be at 7 p.m. at Peace and Justice Plaza in Chapel Hill.
If you want to see analysis on anti-fascist events that have occurred thus far in D.C. and Seville, you can head to crimethink.com and read interviews done with folks who are on the ground there, as well as listen to the most recent Hotwire episode, which deals with these topics. And finally, do not forget that in just a few days, we'll kick off the 2018 prisoner strike, scheduled for August 21st through September 9th. Coming just 2 years after the largest prison strike in U.S. history, this one has the potential to be even bigger.
On Tuesday, August 21st at 5 p.m. at Firestorm Books and Coffee in Asheville, Blue Ridge ABC will be hosting a presentation on the nationwide prison strike, which will include updates on prison conditions and specific prisoners facing repression for supposedly organizing. If you're not in the Asheville area, check out It's Going Down for a list of events that you can clue yourself into, whether they be vigils or teach-ins or letter-writing nights, what have you. Of note, a prisoner at Sterling Correctional Complex in Colorado sent on to a member of an anarchist Black Cross that they correspond with the following message that we've been asked to spirit along like a kite. Quote, "First, I want to send to you and all the Denver ABC my love, respect, and appreciation. Organizations like the APC are the lifeblood of the struggle inside the tombs. I also like this quote. They tried to bury us. They didn't realize we were seeds. It's so true." Which brings me to this topic. Right now, as I write you this myself, as well as 38 other men here in Sterling's MCC, another word for ADSEG, are on 24-hour lockdown for 2 weeks and counting. Some have been on this lockdown for 3 months and counting. At this moment, there are 10 engaged in hunger strike, and by the time you receive this letter, the number will have doubled. I do not know what sort of assistance you could provide, but what I am sending you here below are our 5 demands/points of the hunger strike. And we need help getting this out to the following people: Governor Hickenlooper's office, the warden of Sterling Correctional Facility, Director of Prisons Rick Ramish, the New York Times, the Denver Post, all local Denver news stations, ABC, NBC, CBS, and Fox. You can find more, including the full list of demands, at It's Going Down, by searching for Hunger Strike Sterling.
If you would like more resources and ideas on how to get engaged with this strike and to learn about the strikers' demands, go to prisonstrike.com. And additionally, you can listen to the Rust Belt Abolition Radio episode entitled Prelude to the 2018 Prisoner Strike, done with two members of IWalk Oakland. And also, you can do some research and get in touch with any IWalk chapter that is local to you. And now, here is William C. Anderson at the Asheville Book Fair talking about As Black as Resistance.
Hello? Can you do this?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. All right. Welcome, everyone. Thanks for coming and bearing with the mic trouble. We're really excited to have William C. Anderson come speak tonight. He just published a book, As Black as Resistance, co-written with Zoe Simubzi. Some really exciting book, and I'm just going to throw it to William so that he can talk. What's louder?
Yeah.
Working on it.
Working. That's cool. Yeah, so we're really excited that William was able to come also in time with this book, and I'm just going to give it the mic to him when we have it loud enough, and let him talk. And we also have copies of this book here, too, so... and hopefully we can have some time for conversation afterwards. So thanks a lot for coming, and yeah, if we can just like welcome William. Thanks.
Hello, everyone. How are y'all doing?
Good.
I'm pretty good.
see such a nice turnout. It's really beautiful. Thank you all for coming. I'm pretty informal about these sorts of things, so you know, I'm pretty open to being engaged. Like, don't feel too formal, you know, with this whole talk. Pretty much the entire time I'm here, I want to have conversations that I feel will be productive. And you know, a lot of the inspiration behind this text that I'm going to be talking about was with the intention of people to organize and feel inspired to organize. And so I feel like that's a very, you know, clearly it's a collaborative process, and I want everybody to feel inspired to engage me. You know, if you want to talk to me when this is going on, just, you know, let me know. So this talk is called Black and Anarchy, and basically the talk is named after the first chapter of the book, Is Black as Resistance, that I co-wrote with Zoe Simluzzi. And a little background about this text. We came together a few years back. Zoe and I connected from Twitter, and we were, you know, so interested in each other's political views and each other's politics and writing that we said, hey, why don't we connect and, you know, we'll do something collaborative together, and hopefully it'll, you know, have a, you know, good effect or whatever, right? So after saying that for 2 or 3 years, talking on the phone regularly and saying, when we get off the phone, we're going to do this, we're going to write this, and we're going to do that, and never actually doing it, after those years passed, there was a conversation we had, and we talked about a lot about anarchism. We always were talking about anarchism, but we were both kind of coming to the same spot where we were figuring out some certain things pertaining to being Black and anarchy. And so we were like, okay, let's get off the phone and you know, make it happen. And I didn't think we were actually going to do it, because for years we had just been talking and not doing it. And we made it happen, and we wrote the essay, The Anarchism of Blackness, for War Magazine. So that essay was basically, it was a lot of things, but largely it was almost like a critique of the failures of liberalism, and it was also talking specifically about how liberalism has failed Black people in the United States. And also, we were talking about, again, the anarchism of Blackness, which is a way that we describe the condition of being Black, which is what I'm kind of going to be getting into more today. So today I really want to focus on citizenship, particularly. It's really a problem. It's more so it's the problem of citizenship that I want to focus on. When we're talking about Blackness and we're talking about existing in the United States, there's a lot of assumptions that people have about Blackness and citizenship, and one of those assumptions is that it is something that actually functions for Black people. But I want to talk about why citizenship doesn't actually function, or isn't actually fulfilled, a fulfilled thing that Black people can truly utilize the same way that others can utilize in this country. So I'm going to start off with a quote from a poem by Willie Hohasile, and he's deceased now, rest in peace, but South African poet laureate, also father of the rapper Earl Sweatshirt. Anybody knows Earl Sweatshirt? But he's an amazing poet, very, very influential, huge impact on the Black arts movement. But I'm going to start with this quote from him, because it's relevant. When then did the brutality of imperialist appetite and aggression evolve into something of such ominous value to us that we torture, mutilate, butcher in ways hideous beyond the imagination? What we now claim with perverse possessiveness and territorial chauvinism to be our side of the boundary that until only yesterday arrogantly defined where a piece of one European property ended and another began. In my language, there is no word for citizen, which is an ingredient of that 19th century omelet. That's Willie Hohasile Pogasili. I'm probably messing his name up a little bit. I'm trying. I want to definitely put emphasis on that part. In my language, there is no word for citizen. Remember that. So Sadia Hartman, who was a big influence on this text that Zoe and I wrote, she's influenced a lot of our thinking. I'm going to be quoting a lot of people today. I hope y'all will bear with me. But Sadia Hartman has a quote that I also want to read too. The constituent elements of slavery have not been abolished up to the point that black people fit partially or completely into the realm of animal or human or citizen. She describes the constituent elements of slavery as well as its afterlife. In some terms, she describes these basically these constituent elements of slavery. She describes them as social precarity, the vulnerability to premature death, gratuitous violence, controlled deprivation, and she talks about impaired citizenship. So this, the afterlife of slavery, is basically an academic way that's describing how black folks, after the Emancipation Proclamation, were still existing in the afterlife of slavery. And the afterlife of slavery is a way to describe all of the things that could directly connect us to chattel enslavement. So because of slavery and because of social death, this condition imposed upon black people is something that doesn't actually mesh with citizenship. Black people in this country were told that we're citizens and we should support this country and we should pay our taxes, we should join the military, we should do all of these things, we should vote. But there's always been this problem with blackness and citizenship actually being two things that can actually work together and can coexist. You hear the expression, everybody's probably heard the expression, go back to Africa, right? So it's something that really, really highlights what I'm talking about here. When you hear someone tell a black person who's descended from enslaved Africans to go back to Africa, you have to consider all of the things that are being said there, consciously or subconsciously. What is it about blackness in the United States that interrupts citizenship and that disconnects us from citizenship? And that makes citizenship something that's actually symbolic. Because clearly, because we see the extrajudicial assassinations that happen with police violence, police brutality, we see all of the violence levied against black people. We're in an anti-black society. It's founded on anti-blackness. So there's a constant reckoning that's happening with black people where our citizenship is adversely affected. And I would go as far as to say it doesn't even really truly exist. Zoe and I talk about this much in As Black as Resistance. We quote, say, societal fascism describes the process and political logics of state formation, wherein entire populations are either excluded or ejected from the social contract. They are excluded pre-contractually because they have never been a part of the given social contract and will never be, or they are ejected from a social contract they were previously a part of and are only able to enjoy a conditional inclusion at best. Black Americans are the former. They are residents in a settler colony predicated upon the genocide of indigenous people and the enslavement of Africans from whom they are descendants. Residents of the United States as opposed to citizens of, despite a constitution laden with European Enlightenment values and a document of independence declaring egalitarianism and inalienable rights as the law of the land, black existence was that of private property. The black American condition is a perpetual relegation to the afterlife of slavery. And as long as the United States continues to exist as an ongoing settler project, in this afterlife, black people will remain. So this is where the anarchism of blackness really manifests itself as an experience, as well as like organizing principle. We go on stating, while bound to the laws of the land, black America can be understood as an extra state entity because of black exclusion from the liberal social contract. Due to this extra state location, blackness is in so many ways anarchistic. So that's what we're talking about when we say the anarchism of blackness. Because of this contradiction that blackness poses to citizenship in the United States, it puts black people into a state of anarchy. So when we originally wrote The Anarchism of Blackness, and when we expanded that text into this book, we weren't necessarily writing saying, hey, everybody, we're black anarchists. We are black anarchists. But it was funny because a lot of folks interpreted it as more as a kind of a black anarchist statement. But what we're really talking about is the black condition itself. So we're talking about black people being anarchists because being black in the United States is a state of anarchy. Does everybody see what I'm saying? Because of the way that the black condition functions in this society, and because we exist outside of that social contract, because we're extra state entities in the society, that puts us into a state of anarchy in the first place. So the anarchism of blackness is basically us saying we are primed for radical politics because we're black. Because we're existing in this precarious position in the society where there is so much uncertainty. I can walk outside and be murdered by a white person, a white vigilante. I can be killed by a cop. All of these different acts of gratuitous violence, again, quoting Sadia Hartman, all of these things can happen to me at any moment. So that's what makes what Hartman says when she talks about impaired citizenship, that's what makes that a reality. Thus, the constant threat of overwhelmingly gratuitous violence that is always pervasive in this society, that's always hovering over black people in our existence, right? That is putting us into a state of anarchy. And when I'm talking about actual anarchy, actual, you know, being threatened by the violence of the society, that sort of anarchy, as opposed to, you know, politically being an anarchist. So from that brought us closer, that realization brought us closer to anarchism as a politic, because we clearly were able to say, okay, this is a state of anarchy in the society. We're existing outside of the state because the state does not allow blackness to actually coexist with citizenship in a true form. It's more symbolic, right? So since that's the case, we said, hey, we're actually primed to be radical in the society. We're willing to embrace radical left politics. So that is what makes the anarchism of blackness happen. That's what makes it a thing. So really what we're saying also is, and I've talked about this before at a couple of the other stops on the tour, we are talking about being black anarchists because being black is a state of anarchy, right? So when we're thinking about that, you know, we're talking about we're existing outside of the borders of citizenship. So we have to avoid the language of citizenship as well. You hear a lot of people talk about, you know, how can you do this to U.S. citizens, or how, you know, you can't do this to us. We're citizens. I have human rights as a citizen. And, you know, that really erases and throws undocumented folks under the bus. That throws a lot of people who are also challenging citizenship with their existence. It's not just black folks. There are a lot of people who have conditions in this society that don't coalesce and don't work with citizenship well. That definitely has been the case for Native people. That's part of the reason that the settler colonialist violence that we've seen has been so genocidal, is because of the way that Native people have been a threat to this society just for existing. So this isn't exclusive, something that exclusively works hand in hand with only black people, with just black people, solely black people rather. It's something that is a little bit more expansive than that. But because of the way, again, that I was talking about the afterlife of slavery, and particularly that way that blackness has been explicitly tied to enslavement, that is what creates this particularly unique situation for black folks, particularly those of us who are descended from enslaved Africans. So, let's see. Citizenship kind of turns us into people the way that folks use citizenship and talk about citizenship in our movements a lot of times. It's really problematic because citizenship almost kind of makes people into like these like microcosms of the state. Like people start talking about how they have these rights because they're a citizen, that really is a way of like subtly reinforcing the logics of state brutality, because citizenship being tied directly to the state and being tied into nationalism the way that people do when they claim it as a defense mechanism, and they say like, oh, you can't do this to me, I'm a citizen. It really reinforces the legitimacy of the state in a way that we absolutely shouldn't be doing it, in my opinion. And so thinking about that as well, when we talk about the anarchism of blackness, that is a rejection. That is a rejection of the state. We're saying that the state is not actually legitimate. It's anti-black. So why would I want to legitimize something that poses me a threat and actually is possibly going to kill me at any given moment of my life every day? So rejecting citizenship through the anarchism of blackness, thinking about it as an organizing principle that primes black folks for radical politics, and thinking about how anarchism in general has the principles that we can directly correlate to blackness is some of the things I want us to think about right now. So it's a problem throughout the African diaspora, and we're seeing this right now actually quite a bit. In Canada, there was a Nigerian man recently who immigrated to Canada from Nigeria when he became a citizen in 1996. And this man recently was actually detained. This was this month, actually. He was detained in Canada, and he was like, I'm a citizen. He showed his identification, and the Canadian police put him in a detention center anyway. And that's just one example of what I'm talking about here. Is everybody kind of following where I'm going with this? I just want to make sure everybody's good, because everybody looks very pensive right now. And I'm kind of like looking like, oh, we good? Okay, good, awesome. Again, if you have a question or want to say anything, you know, just jump in. So this Canadian man was detained. He's a Nigerian immigrant. And they detained him despite him having citizenship. And they put him in a detention center. He's suing the Canadian government for $10 million. This just happened. He spent 8 months in detention, despite the fact he was a citizen. In Mexico, in the last couple of years, for the first time ever, the Mexican government is recognizing its 1.38 million citizens of African descent in a national survey. They're just now being formally recognized by the Mexican government. These are Afro-Mexican people, and they are, again, descended from enslaved Africans as well. And so it's something to ask ourselves, why is it that they're just now, at this point, being recognized? That's something to think about as well, right? In Britain, I'm sure a lot of you have heard about the Windrush generation. Have people been hearing about this in the news? Okay, well, I'll explain it. The Windrush generation is a group of people who came to the UK between 1948 and 1971, particularly from Caribbean countries. And they've been labeled the Windrush generation because they came on this ship called the Windrush. So clearly these are folks from the Commonwealth who are coming from the former colonies of Britain. A lot of folks who are Jamaican, for example, came to Britain during this time with the promise that if they were, you know, loyal to the state, you know, did things for Britain, fought in the war, that they would have their citizenship and they would have the promise of a better life in Britain. So you have this group of folks right now who are now in their, some of them 60s, 70s, maybe even 80s, and Britain is deporting them. And they're saying, what are you doing? We have citizenship. I fought in the war. I'm from Jamaica. I have my citizenship for you know, being from the island and coming here and doing everything I was supposed to do. And Britain is actually deporting, saying that they did not fill out the appropriate paperwork, or their parents didn't fill out the appropriate paperwork, and they're actually deporting people from this generation, despite the fact that clearly, they have invested a lot of their lives. These are people who have spent their entire life. Some of these folks went to Britain for the first time and got started there with their parents when they were as young as, you know, 4 or 5 years old. And now at, you know, someone in their 70s is being deported, told that they're not a true citizen, and that their paperwork isn't necessarily valid. And again, these are primarily black folks in Britain, right? Black immigrants. So those are a few examples. We can think of also, too, about Ethiopian Jewish folks in Israel. That's another example that I think about a lot. And the way that their Jewishness is invalidated by the Israeli state because they're black, and as well as other black Jewish folks in Israel. This is something that's happening internationally.
Here's a jingle for a show on the Channel Zero network of anarchist podcasts.
Too busy trying to survive capitalism's daily grind to get caught up on the latest anarchist news? Or maybe you're so wrapped up in your own organizing that it's hard to make time to hear about other liberatory struggles. This Rebel Girl has got you covered. Tune in every Wednesday for new episodes of The Hot Wire, a 30-minute podcast with the latest anarchist news, on-the-ground interviews, a repression roundup, political prisoner birthdays, and announcements for upcoming events. All this and more at crimethink.com.
As we're seeing this resurgence of fascism around the globe right now, there's clearly a moment happening where these states, these Western states, are clearly threatened by this idea, this liberal idea of diversity, right? As symbolic as it is, because we just had Barack Obama as president before Trump, right? And people thought that meant that the world was the perfect place now and everything was going to be great. We have a black president, so racism is over. Yay. And, you know, people just felt so inspired. And I'm not going to lie, I felt inspired at the time when I was, you know, 18, voting for my first time. I was, I guess, describing myself as a socialist at that point, but I still had I still had some Democratic Party leanings. And it was my first time voting, so I was like, okay, this is, you know, I'm not one of those folks who I want to get up here and front like I was born radical. I wasn't. So at that time, I felt so inspired, I was, you know, really, really excited, like many folks were, about the presidency with Barack Obama. And ultimately, we saw that as this moment that things, well, many of us saw that at that time as a moment where things were changing for the better and that the world was headed in maybe a better direction. Clearly, we can see what happened now. And there is a backlash that's happening. Maybe some folks wouldn't agree with me on that, but I do think that a lot of what we're seeing right now in this current political moment is a backlash to this sort of diversity movement that we've had going on for years now. But that presidency, that Barack Obama's presidency, really was like a major manifestation of that push to make things better through diversity and reform, right? So now we're seeing this backlash throughout the West to immigration. I think in this country, largely what we see with Donald Trump's presidency, I think that is largely, in many ways, a reaction on behalf of white America to Barack Obama's presidency. When Barack Obama was president, the right-wing hate groups in this country, white supremacist groups, saw higher membership than they ever have. And it was constantly rising during those 8 years. So all of that, thinking about immigration too, and the xenophobic currencies, and all these things have existed, but just the way that they were escalating during Obama's presidency, and now this backlash that we're seeing throughout the West, whether it was like Marine Le Pen with France, or what we're seeing with Theresa May in Britain, or the countless white supremacists. We just had this conservative get elected in Colombia. The head of the state in Guatemala, the president of Guatemala, is a former blackface actor. The president that we see who replaced, Lord, what's her name? in Brazil. Dilma. Thank you. She slips my name. Her name slips my head. My mom. Dilma, the president who replaced Dilma, Temer in Brazil, fascists, white supremacists, trying to reverse all of the gains that Afro-Brazilians had made. This is a moment that we're seeing where it's absolutely necessary for us to organize around all of this misery that's happening, because we are seeing this kind of battle cry from white supremacy globally. There's this shift happening, and it's absolutely imperative that we organize and that we be very, very persistent, because a lot of people right now are disheveled and they're very upset about, what do I do? How do I make this better? What this, you know, I thought I was just supposed to vote. This is the time where we need to be telling people about how liberalism is failing. This is the time where we need to be telling people about, well, liberalism is a failure. It's not just failing, it's a complete failure. This is the time we need to be talking to folks about this, because this is right now when people are feeling vulnerable. This is the time to be telling people why we need a real left. So again, going back to the anarchism of blackness, that is part of our message is, hey, this is a situation that we're in this country. We were put into this predicament. And so now's the time for us to be organizing around our predicament. And rejecting this notion of nationalism being some sort of saving grace, or of patriotism being something that's going to help us. The state doesn't need us to reinvest in it. It doesn't need us to affirm it by saying, oh, this country's so great, we've been better and da-da-da. No, it's always been horrible. It's always been a threat to black people. It's always been something that has been a threat to this entire world. Ever since the United States was established, this country has been established on brutality, not only to Native people, not only to black people, but to the entire world. Because to build a state up at the speed that the United States is a young country. To build a state up at the speed that we know that the United States was established in took a lot of really, really horrible, really like horrific things that we know took place in history and that are still taking place and we're still connected to in this moment. So with that being said, it's like, what is this organizing principle I'm talking about with the anarchism of blackness? What is that? Where are we going with that? How can we organize through the anarchism of blackness, or the anarchistic experiences that many people experience in this country because they don't fit into this white ideal or into the ideological whiteness that dominates the society? Basically, one of the things we drew from in the text is Huey P. Newton. And Huey P. Newton, the founder of the Black Panther Party, he came up with a theory called intercommunalism, revolutionary intercommunalism. I first found out about this theory because of Lorenzo Kumbora Urban, who we also quote in the text. We had to pay homage to him because he is a black anarchist who is really amazing. If you haven't read his book, Anarchism and the Black Revolution, it's hard to come by, but if you can come by it, definitely write that down and check it out. It's a magnificent text. But the first time I saw that about intercommunalism with Huey P. Newton, it was in Lorenzo's book, and he was actually posing the question, should we go with intercommunalism or Pan-Africanism? Now, to be more specific about what intercommunalism is, I'm going to read a little bit from Huey P. Newton here. In 1966, we called our party a Black Nationalist Party. We called ourselves Black Nationalists because we thought that nationhood was the answer. Shortly after that, we decided that what was really needed was a revolutionary nationalism, that is, nationalism plus socialism. After analyzing conditions a little more, we found that that was impractical and even contradictory. Therefore, we went to a higher level of consciousness. We saw that in order to be free, we had to crush the ruling circle, and therefore we had to unite with peoples of the world. So we called ourselves internationalists. We saw solidarity with peoples of the world. We saw solidarity with what we thought were the nations of the world. But then what happened? we found that because everything, we found that because everything is in constant state of transformation, in a constant state of transformation, because of the development of technology, because of the development of mass media, because of the firepower of the imperialists, and because of the fact that the United States is no longer a nation, but an empire, nations could not exist, for they do not have the criteria for nationhood. Their self-determination, economic determination, and cultural determination has been found that in order to be internationalists, we have to also be nationalists, or at least acknowledge nationhood. Internationalism, if I understand the word, means the interrelationship among a group of nations. But since no nation exists, and since the United States is in fact an empire, it is impossible for us to be internationalists. So these transformations and these phenomena require us to call ourselves intercommunalists, because nations have been transformed into communities of the world, and the Black Panther Party now disclaims internationalism and supports intercommunalism. So Huey talked about how the ruling reactionary circle, through the consequence of being imperialist, transformed the world into what we call reactionary intercommunalism. And they laid siege to the communities of the world, dominating the institutions to such an extent that people were not served by the institutions in their own land. The Panthers hoped to reverse that trend and lead to what the people of the world in this age would call revolutionary intercommunalism. We still have to attend to this work and really like embrace the anarchism of blackness and work against the state with this principle. Intercommunalism and creating survival programs is really the whole thesis of the Black Panther Party and their praxis. The free breakfast program, for example, that's what we're talking about. It's establishing survival programs where we know how the state is failing us. Like, we know that. We know how the state is brutalizing us. So we're kind of like in this moment, and we've been in this moment with several of our movements, where we see all these folks who are organizing, right? And the organizing is oftentimes very reactionary. A lot of the things that we see day to day, we see something happen in the news, and then people say, oh, we got to get up and you got to do something. We got to go do this. We got to go do that. And then they go organize, and they're there, and they're doing something in the community at this particular site of violence. And then something else happens. And then everybody turns their attention to that, and they go, oh, this is happening now. We got to go over here. We got to support this. And then folks are over there doing that. And then it's like this other thing that they were doing before, that didn't get finished. There was no actual resolution. So, you know, it's like Flint. It's Flint one day. Then the next day it's the children who are being detained. And then this other day is that there's no heating in the Baltimore City schools. Or then the other day is, oh, they don't have clean water in Selma. And folks there, so folks kind of jump around into these different causes, and nothing ever gets resolved. So what we can learn from the Black Panther Party, and what we can learn from talking about Huey's revolutionary intercommunalism, is that the reason the Black Panthers established the free breakfast program was because they knew that there was a need. This is not happening. These kids are not getting breakfast, and that's important. There's research that shows that these kids eat breakfast, they're going to be better in school, they're going to be better throughout the day, it's healthier for them. So let's have a free breakfast program so they can come get breakfast in the morning. So thinking about that, we have to keep establishing these survival programs to this day, because we know what the state is doing. What do we have set up that is proactive organizing that's not reactionary? What do we have set up for undocumented folks to stop these deportations? What do we have set up to interrupt Black people being unjustly arrested? And I'm not saying that any arrests are just, but what do we have set up to stop arrest, period, when folks are being detained by the police? What do we have set up to feed people who are impoverished, who need assistance? What kind of health care can we establish for people in the community who aren't able to afford to go to the doctor? Having these programs set up, tying that in to the anarchism of blackness, Through looking at Huey's intercommunalism and looking at how Black people exist outside of the contract, the liberal social contract, and looking at how blackness is contradictory to citizenship, saying that this is absolutely necessary, and organizing people around that understanding, saying that we're not actually truly citizens in this country. We're not actually ever going to be able to live up to the promises of this country because blackness is a contradiction to citizenship. How can we establish programs that let people know that since they're not living, able to live up to this promise of citizenship, and the promises of citizenship aren't going to be granted to them, how can we organize people to better, not only better understand why it's in their best interest, but also just have proactive means set up that counter the state? Because one great way to organize people is to fulfill a need for them where they automatically start feeling inspired. Because I'm going to tell you this much right now, if you can give somebody that's hungry a meal, they're going to be a lot more willing to listen to you than if you're not able to do anything for them. So it's like part of the reason we have to establish these sorts of survival programs is because, again, during this moment of terror and onslaught in the United States that is particularly bad, a lot of people are very desperate. And we know that a lot of the things that we're going to see later are going to be maybe even possibly worse than what's happening now, because certain things that are happening, the effects aren't going to be fully felt until somewhere down the road. So it's like, since we know this is the case, since we saw what happened with Puerto Rico, right? We know what happened in Texas. What is the plan, the proactive plan for organizing? How do we embrace the conditions that were imposed upon us as black people, as native folks, as anybody in this room, no matter what your identity is or no matter how you declare yourself in this nation? What are our proactive plans for our respective communities based on the ways that we know the state is going to fail and that we know the state is going to brutalize us? So the anarchism of blackness as an organizing principle is embracing the anarchy that the state imposes upon black people and organizing through it, the same way that the Maroon communities, for example, challenged the state when black folks and when Native folks were seeing that, hey, this state that is establishing itself is not going to accept us. It's not going to work with us. In the book, we talk about the Maroon in Florida during the Second Seminole War that was led by John Horse and the Black Seminoles. That particular experience was, that piece of history was very, very special because it has so many of these traits that I'm talking about with the anarchism of blackness. When the black Seminoles, who were sometimes enslaved by the Seminole people, or who were just joined up with the Seminole people, it depends on the person. There was a lot of different type of conditions that black people joined the Seminoles under. But this particular group of folks in this very special part of history were in conflict with so many things happening around them because they were not able to be citizens because they were black. Clearly, they were enslaved outside of the Seminole Nation, and they were sometimes enslaved by the Seminoles, and they weren't able to completely become a part of the Seminole Nation as black people. They weren't considered true Seminoles, even if they may have had like a Seminole parent or no matter what. Those folks held off the U.S. government in one of the longest running insurgencies in the history of this country. They actually secured the first Emancipation Proclamation from the U.S. government prior to Lincoln's. And they got it from a general named Jessup. And he wrote explicitly that it was because they were fighting so hard against the U.S. government. He said that this war, he said it was a black war. He said it was a Negro war, not an Indian war. That was the quote. And he basically was admitting that because of the conditions that black people were experiencing under enslavement at that time, they felt that they had nothing to lose. They felt that I would rather die than go back to being enslaved. So they were joining with the Seminoles to create this force, this vast Maroon force that was holding off the U.S. government because they felt, you're just going to kill me before you put me back in chains. That same logic and that same sort of resistance, again, is what we're tying into the anarchism of blackness when we talk about it today and when we mention it in this text. that sort of I have nothing to lose mentality is exactly what we need still to this day. And when we look around and we see the conditions outside and we see everything that's happening, what do we have to lose? Because the state of capitalism right now that we're living under is absolutely going to destroy this world. There's no question about it. This world is not going to be able to exist. And really, I should say the earth, because there's a difference really when we're talking about all of this between saying the world as we know it, the society as we know it, I feel like that needs to end. And I say that because this is an anti-black society, this is a white supremacist society, and this is a society that doesn't need to continue any longer. When I'm talking about the world being necessary to end, that's something completely different. But the earth as we know it, being threatened by this state of capitalism,
CKUT Radio.
Sound waves in the air.
CKUT
Montreal, Canada. CKUT.
Welcome back to Off the Hour on CKUT 90.3 FM. You were just listening to an episode of The Final Straw Radio with William Anderson. If you want to hear more about this episode or catch the rest, you can go to finalstrawradio.libsyn.com. And before you go, here's some news that you can use on CKUT 90.3 FM. There are still walk-in COVID-19 booster slots available at the Olympic Stadium. It's open every day with an appointment, and walk-ins are welcome from 8 a.m. to 8:30 p.m. That's at the Olympic Stadium on 4545 Avenue Pierre de Coubertin. And the Center for Gender Advocacy has begun an 8-week elder-in-residence program. Kanyenke Haga and Ojibwe elder Tom Deerhouse will lead a series of lectures based around indigenous traditions and student learning. His second lecture is called Healing from Trauma, Grief, and Loss, next Wednesday on Zoom at 10 a.m. You can learn more on Instagram at gender.advocacy. And there's a free ice skating event tonight at Parc des Faubourgs. It's called Disco Patin sous les Étoiles, and it runs until 10 p.m. Vaccine passports are required, and ice skating support from the city will be offered. The McGill Tribune began its 8th annual Journalism and Media Conference today. The 2-day online conference ends at 8 p.m. tomorrow and features workshops and panels, all about the role of subjectivity in journalism.
Esto es únicamente una prueba. Uno, dos, uno, dos.
In Montreal.
CKUT. All the rhythms, all the music, all the time.
90.3 FM.
In the case of symptoms similar to those of COVID-19, such as fever, cough, sore throat, loss of taste, or smell, you should take a rapid home screening test. If you test positive, isolate yourself at home and please follow the self-isolation instructions. If you don't have a rapid home screening test, please self-isolate for the recommended period. Visit quebec.ca/self-isolating for complete instructions on how to protect yourself and others. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
The Prison Radio Show is a twice-monthly news show on CKUT. The show seeks to confront the invisibility of prisons and prisoner struggles by focusing on the roots of incarceration, policing, and criminalization, and by challenging ideas about what prisons are and who ends up inside. We are dedicated to programming that is directly collaborative with people who are currently incarcerated. With that in mind, we would like to let you know that we have a phone line for prisoners and their outside supporters. In fact, we have 2 phone lines. You can call us Collect from Bordeaux Prison and Riviere de Prairie Prison by calling 514-876-3748. We also have a number for non-Collect calls. That number is 438-337-8423. Feel free to call that number and leave a message for us with news to share on the show or an audio message for your loved ones inside.
Radio Montréal, voix de la ville mondiale.
90.3 FM is proud to rebroadcast the following program entirely in the Mohawk language. The Mohawk, or Ganyatgehaga, are the original people of the unceded traditional territory known as Montreal, or Chojaake. The Ganyatgehaga, or people of the Flint, have two communities close by, and they are working hard at revitalizing their language. This program is part of those efforts, and it originally aired in Ganasadage on RKR, reviving Ganasadage Radio. And now, listen to Chojaake's indigenous language on CKUT.
Oscar Wanarke, Gonki Iges, Wanitio, Danum Jarazeson.
Kana sa daga gari huanata.